This is 40ANM N5, a download of 40ANM LLC, recorded at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, December 9th. I'm Chris Bohm, and this is our weekly selection of tech sector related global news and policy highlights from the past week. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court declines to weigh in on online sales tax issues, putting the ball squarely in Congress's court. But will Congress act? The French High Court in Paris acts to have search engines and ISPs block access to 16 websites trafficking in pirated content. The chair of the European Body of European Regulators for Electronic Communications speaks to Parliament in support of a connected continent. The U.S.'s National Public Radio and others debate the economic drivers for clean energy. Amazon.com CEO wants to do deliveries via unmanned flying drones. Will you see them in the air anytime soon? And the EU-US safe harbor arrangement for data protection, under fire, but with a reprieve from the European Commission. But first, all but five states in the U.S. impose sales taxes on purchases, whether or not the purchases are made online. Customers in states with sales taxes are supposed to remit taxes on purchases that they make from online retailers, but if the retailer itself doesn't collect it, few customers do on their own. According to the Washington Post and the National Conference of State Legislatures, estimates are that states lost close to $23 billion in tax revenue in 2012, about half of which was due to lost taxes on online sales. However, on Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to force web retailers to collect these taxes from customers located in states where the retailers don't already have a physical presence. The court acted without giving a specific rationale, but the move, according to Washington Post Robert Barnes, puts increasing pressure on Congress to come up with a solution. According to the Post, Amazon's website states that it now collects taxes in 16 states, including Virginia, Texas, and California. 20 years ago, the Supreme Court had ruled in Quill v. North Dakota that for a state to require tax collections from out-of-state companies would violate the Constitution's Commerce Clause. But that was long before today's digital economic environment, and the court's reluctance to step in here likely signals that the Quill view may be outdated in the context of e-commerce. The Senate had passed the Marketplace Fairness Act of 2013 in the spring, which would require companies that exceed $1 million in internet sales outside the states where they are located to collect every state sales tax. But its future in the House is today uncertain, where some bristle at the notion of a tax burden for constituents, irrespective of whether that burden now exists in law. The French High Court in Paris has ordered Google, Microsoft, and Yahoo, and numerous others, including ISPs, to begin blocking and related measures against 16 video streaming sites. Citing that the websites were primarily dedicated to the distribution of works without the consent of their creators, the court will have portals like Google and Yahoo block the sites from being taken up in their search results. ISPs like Orange and others will need to find a way to effectively block their users from accessing the sites. The case had been brought by five groups representing film, distribution, and production companies. Blocking requirements like this have always been technically difficult and discouraged by ISPs, as once a site is blocked, it's fairly easy for the offending site to move to a new location, blunting the effectiveness of any block. In addition, even a well-executed block by an ISP often results in numerous non-offending sites also getting caught up in the technical implications of the block's website's domain. Still, the BBC reports that the Motion Picture Association welcomed the ruling, noting that the 16 sites targeted and the pirated material they had trafficked in had made it particularly difficult for consumers by doing economic damage to the legal download market. The search companies and the ISPs will have 2 weeks to implement the court's requirements. Dr. Leonidas Kanellos, chair of the European Body of European Regulators for Electronic Communications, or BEREC, addressed the European Parliament's ITRA committee meeting in Brussels on November 28th. The focus of his remarks was Parliament's deliberation over the European Commission's Connected Continent proposal. The Barrick has had a long history with this topic, having issued a statement on the proposal back on September 16th, and then a summary position favorable to it on the 17th of October. The latter issuance by the Barrick strongly endorsed a key aim of the package of regulatory reform proposals, which was harmonization. In his remarks, Dr. Canellas got firmly behind the goal of creating a single European authorization template for communications operators, creating both predictability and legal certainty. The balance here, he stated, would be to enable national regulators to continue basic market monitoring, along with the light authorization regime, ensuring smooth market access by operators. He pledged the work of the Barrick to draw up a harmonized notification procedure and template in 2014. On the issue of competition, including regulated communications network access products and related remedies, Dr. Canellas expressed the Barrick's preference for a specific wholesale access remedy and detailed technical characteristics. However, he cautioned that the most appropriate regulatory remedies must, in his words, be attentive to the real differences in network rollout, technology, and the commercial needs across Europe. There is no one-size-fits-all, and these needs are continually evolving. Thus, he agreed with the approach of the ITRA Committee's draft report on the proposal, recommending development of regulatory best practices approaches. And with the Barrick itself, one of the key achievements of the European Regulatory Framework revisions adopted in 2009, Dr. Canellas ended with a note of caution, recommending that any intention to improve or adapt the Barrick should be carefully considered. Last Saturday, National Public Radio's Richard Harris reported in NPR's Weekend Edition that a split exists among experts on the prospects for clean energy. Whereas there is broad consensus among experts on the need to keep global warming in check, it will require, according to NPR, that we phase out nearly 80% of all oil, coal, and natural gas use by mid-century. President Obama had set a non-binding set of targets to do just that, but whereas the technologists are optimistic, economists, according to NPR, who view the economic feasibility of the targets, are not. Given current green energy-producing technologies like wind, solar, and others, the balance of costs to implement these technologies, when weighed against the savings from potential improvements on efficient energy use, are not promising. The argument was made in the NPR story that if a price was put on the environmental damage caused by carbon dioxide, clean forms of energy, like solar, could become comparatively cheaper. It was noted that the grid would have to be reconfigured to handle disparate drawing from all of these alternative energy sources. But where there is money to be made, innovation could surely follow. A similar argument was made by the International Chamber of Commerce in 2011, in a piece it published on the interaction of information and communication technologies with goals for environmental sustainability. In it, the ICC suggested that putting the same energy and focus in taking carbon out of business processes will deliver competitive advantages while simultaneously supporting the sustainability agenda. Included in this focus could be the modeling of costs and associated carbon emissions generated from activities, identifying and messaging on the dependencies that drive cost and carbon emissions, prioritizing and cost-justifying so-called green investments by demonstrating impact and potential short, medium, and long-term cost savings, and finally, ensuring the alignment of sustainability objectives with strategic goals. The NPR Weekend Edition story can be found at www.npr.org, and the ICC paper is available at www.iccwbo.org. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos announced earlier this week that he wants to have drones, unmanned miniature aircraft, specifically versions for Prime subscribers, deliver packages weighing up to 5 pounds in 30 minutes by as early as 2018 or 19. Now, before you roll your eyes or worry about numerous drones crashing into one another or others as they roam about the skies with your packages, the belief is that Amazon could perhaps find a profit margin among deployment of a fleet of drones. Consider, for instance, that a 5-pound limit covers virtually 86% of all the packages that Amazon presently delivers, and that Amazon could potentially depreciate its fleet of drones, according to ZDNet, and it may not sound all that bizarre. That is, if you believe that there will be Prime subscribers out there that are eager for instant gratification to employ a drone for delivery. But yet, at the moment, and perhaps thankfully for some, it's just messaging. And Amazon, apart from its immense retail and e-commerce prowess, is very good at this. CEO Jeff Bezos is known for great headlines, and his firm is known for first-of-its-kind innovation. But as for the Federal Aviation Administration, which would have to clear such drone use rules for Amazon or anyone else for that matter, it will not be ready to do so in 5 years' time, no matter how optimistic you may find the announcement. European privacy regulators and legislators, and German ones in particular, have been very critical of the EU-US safe harbor arrangement for data protection. The safe harbor had been negotiated between the European Commission and the US Department of Commerce in the year 2000 as a means to overcome the vast differences between the strict conservatism of EU privacy rules and the looser sector-by-sector arrangement of the US. To date, more than 4,000 companies have self-certified to the Department of Commerce that their privacy practices are in compliance with the EU rules for purposes of EU data. The perception among many in Europe is that this is it. Once you self-certify, there is no stick to ensure that companies are following through. And this is a perception that the US Federal Trade Commission has vigorously rejected, citing its own record, particularly since 2009, in enforcing the safe harbor assertions by US companies. Nevertheless, the hostility in the wake of the continuing Snowden revelations has reached a fever pitch. The perception now is that not only may the safe harbor be inadequate, but also the seriousness between allies that it embodied on a key European issue is largely ignored by law enforcement. Late last month, the European Commission issued its long-awaited report on EU-US data flows. Although the report does not put an end to the agreement, it is highly critical, recommending over a dozen improvements to be made to the agreement, improvements that U.S. authorities will have to put in place by the summer of 2014. The report was, in fact, highly critical of the agreement's enforcement, suggesting that as much as 10% of self-certifying companies are actually falsely claiming to be compliant. The implication that the Commission seems to be drawing here is that EU companies, when put side by side with safe harbor certifying U.S. companies, are at a distinct disadvantage by virtue of a requirements and enforcement imbalance. Among the recommendations is an obligation for self-certifying companies to only permit the national security exception to the safe harbor rules to be used if it is strictly necessary and proportionate, which implies that the Commission expects companies to start pushing back on calls for blanket surveillance. In addition, companies will have to publish within their posted privacy policies details on the extent to which U.S. law permits its law enforcement to access safe harbor protected data. The changes will also require companies to disclose privacy policies and any conditions that are driven by a company's relationship with third-party vendors. U.S. companies are no doubt relieved that the arrangement was not revoked entirely, which was a distinct possibility. But the report does present a drubbing for the program. European authorities no doubt would prefer to see safe harbor survive, particularly when it is viewed in context with the ongoing negotiations between the EU and US for Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, and the increased economic activity that this could bring. In the final analysis, though, as critical as the report is of safe harbor, its language is tempered, perhaps reflecting the hope that US and EU officials can continue side discussions toward further agreement on privacy, which, according to last month's meeting between U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder and European Commission Vice President Viviane Reding, ambitiously seeks a deal by mid-2014. On Tuesday of this past week, I went to my local library to get a new book and was compelled to pick up Anthony Sampson's biography of Nelson Mandela. I had read his autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom, some years ago, but for some reason felt the need to return to the subject via a different route. Thus, with Thursday's news that Nelson Mandela had passed away, I couldn't help but marvel at the legacy of a man whose very dignity and perseverance has personified true leadership for so many, like me, privileged to have grown up in the midst of the remarkable changes in South Africa during and after his imprisonment on Robben Island. So many of us are richer because, for a time, Nelson Mandela walked among us and with us. And with that, this will be all for 48 AM and 5 this week. All stories for this week's podcast were reported by at least two online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from the New York Times, National Public Radio, ZDNet, the BBC, and the Washington Post. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. Thank you, as always, for listening. 40 AM and 5 will be back with you again on Monday, December 16th, for our final episode of 2013. Until then, make this week, and every week, one to remember. And bye for now.